back to Authors on the Air. I'm your host, Pam Stack. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. This is my second special show for Tuesday night. I'm normally here on Wednesdays, but this warranted a second show. My guest tonight is Eric Beatner. He told me to, when I invited him to come on the show, he said, throw me really tough questions. And that's really, really hard because he's really kind of the nicest guy in crime fiction today. But let me tell you a little bit about Eric. He writes hard-boiled crime, for those of you who don't know. He writes a lot of it, by the way, and he says there's more to come. Besides all the books that he writes, he's been a musician, a painter, he does screenplays, he's acted in short films, he's been to China twice, he finished in the Mississippi, which is really, I think, kind of cool, never mind China. He once met Barry Manilow, I can't wait to hear this story. He's directed films, music videos, his name's been on TV over 100 times, he owns a real human skull, I gotta ask about that, and his kids embarrass him. He says this is a life well lived. Now, besides that, in his spare time, he writes crime. He designs book covers for crime novels, and he also hosts a terrific podcast. With that, I welcome Eric Beatner to Authors on the Air. Hi, Eric. How are you?
I'm very well, Pam. Thank you for having me.
You have done it all. There's not one thing you haven't done in the creative realm that you haven't tried at least once or four times. Is there?
Probably not, but I'm reminded constantly of that old chestnut, jack of all trades, master of none, because
I don't think that's true at all. I think you're a master of many, including your books and your podcast particularly, of which I am very envious. Writer types is so well done and sounds so professional, yet here you are on my Funny Farm broadcast. How did that happen?
Well, my co-host, S.W. Loudon, another fine author, and I, we both live in Los Angeles, so we spend a lot of time together. And he and I both have a background in playing in bands and coming from sort of an independent music scene. So he and I are independent of each other. We're not content to sit on the sidelines. We're very much those kind of kids who are sort of like, you've got a bar and I've got a bed sheet. Let's put on a show.
There you go.
So get us together. And we came up with this idea of the kind of show that we wanted to do because, you know, we don't want to just copy you and the brilliant show that you put together. So we decided to sort of take on our own thing. And if you add into the mix my background with editing, because that's my day job is I'm television editor. So I tend to like my life edited out just the boring parts. You know,
I'll
try to clean up all our interviews and make everyone sound as smart as they possibly can, including Steve and I, which we need for sure.
That's not true. I think you're both brilliant, but I love this. You've been called the James Brown of noir, the hardest working man in crime fiction. How do you feel about that?
I feel very flattered by that. I'm glad somebody's noticing. I think I spend a lot of time trying to help other authors and help promote people and you know, other books that I love and people that I feel like need attention for their writing. Cause I do know how hard it is out there just to rise above the ocean of other books and other artists out there trying to get noticed. So, you know, I think being a part of the crime fiction community and any sort of artistic community, really the best way to be a part of a community is to help others and to promote and to really jump in with both feet and try to get your voice out there. So I think that's what I try to do with the, you know, I host the Noir at the Bar readings here in Los Angeles that have given a lot of people an opportunity to get up in front of an audience. You know, now we do the podcast. I'll try to do whatever I can to get other people and to get the recognition that they deserve. And if that eventually kind of reflects back on me and gets me known as a nice guy who's willing to give another author a hand up, then that's perfectly fine.
it is the kind of profession that is very collegial and very willing to help one another, which is, I think, something people would be surprised to learn, because most writers are not willing to self-promote. And in this day and age, you kind of have to. So, you know, you're really doing the work of you're doing good work by helping others. I want to talk to you about one of your books that is a particular favorite of mine, but you edit it. I love that you do editing so much and you do it so well. Your books are really well done. Never mind the ones that I read, but you edited a book called Unloaded, and I like the fact that this book is out there, and I really want to encourage people to go and to buy that book, that anthology. I think it's particularly relevant, you know, now because of what's happened in the past, you know, obviously 2 weeks. Can you talk a little bit about Unloaded, please?
Yeah, Unloaded was a real passion project of mine, and the conceit behind the book, and I'm proud to see a second volume that is upcoming later this summer. Second volume will be out in July. But the idea was to get crime and mystery writers together and to challenge them to write a story that has all the excitement and thrills that we love about crime fiction, but with no guns, just to leave guns entirely off the page. And to, in that small way, and I acknowledge that it's a small way. I know I'm not going to change the world. I'm not really going to move the needle in Washington, for Pete's sake, or anything. But in our small way, for the writers involved to sort of take a stand and to use our talent that we have to say that we can do without the guns for a little while. And if we can do without them in our work, where many of us rely on them and sometimes rely on them maybe a little too heavily, I know I felt like I did. But if we can do that, then maybe we as a society in America can leave the guns out of our real lives, because we all, everyone involved in this project, acknowledges that the gun violence in the United States is out of control. And I know for me, the idea originally started from my own guilt, I guess, in a way. I was questioning whether I was part of the problem, because that's one of the first things that a lot of people will accuse the entertainment industry, you know, film, TV, books, anything that can seemingly glorify violence as being a part of the problem. And as much as I may disagree with that, you know, it does force you to sort of evaluate your own work and your own contribution to say, well, gosh, I have these personal feelings that I want more gun control, and I don't want my kids to feel threatened at school or to run the risk of, you know, any sort of mass shooting that's going to take out any of my family or loved ones or even strangers, for that sake. So I wanted to do more than just sort of rant on Twitter, because I think that sometimes you feel very helpless when you do that. So, you know, like I said before, I'm not one to sit on the sidelines idly by and do nothing. So when I started to float this idea with a couple of other writer friends that, I knew their politics going in because of stuff that they had posted on social media. So it wasn't like I was totally approaching people and saying, hey, what do you think about this hot button topic? I was sure. Going after people that I knew would align politically with the idea. And, you know, as you said earlier, the crime fiction community is, you know, kind and generous to a fault. And this was no exception. I mean, everyone that I approached, you know, gave of their time and their talent, because we're taking all the money and giving it to charity, into these, you know, gun control lobby groups. So no one's making any money off this, including the publisher Down and Out. So, you know, applause to all the contributors and to Down and Out for stepping up and putting all the effort that goes into these books. But yeah, I think it's such a shame, you know, in my introduction to the second volume, I start that introduction by saying, I wish this book didn't exist. But in the, you know, year and a half in between volume one and volume two, not only has the gun violence in America continued unabated, you know, we've hit a new record for the deadliest mass shooting, as you mentioned, you know, down in Florida just a little over a week ago. We had yet another school shooting where innocent children were killed. I mean, it's this issue is not going anywhere. So we can continue to use the skills that we have, which is our words, to try to make a statement and try to raise our voices a little bit.
Well, first of all, congratulations on the nomination for the Anthony for the anthology. It's truly a remarkable book because I was so surprised. You have, I think, 25 authors who contributed to Unloaded, and each and every story was different. And each and every story was just spectacular without using a gun as the agent of injury or death. You don't even notice, actually, if not for the title and the premise behind the book, you don't notice that this isn't quality crime. It's still quality crime fiction. You don't notice that there's not a gun involved with it. So your writers and, you know, I know who they are, did a spectacular job. I mean, they really did. And each story.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing. I mean, when you give the people this, you know, only this one little caveat, I said, write whatever you want. You know, anything goes except you can't have a gun on it, because I didn't want to give people too much of a restriction. The only downside of that is, you have a collection that is really eclectic. And, you know, same thing goes with Volume 2. I mean, some of the stories, you put them all together and it was hard to sort of find the right order of things because you are, in a way, swinging wildly between stuff that's you know, really dark and noir, and then there's stuff, you know, there's a monkey that goes on the loose in Volume 2. There's one that's more like science fiction. There's androids in one of the stories. You know, it goes kind of crazy when you give people the freedom to write whatever they want and with just this one tiny little restriction. So, people's creativity was really on display.
Are you using the same authors, or have you invited a new group of authors to come in and write?
It is 24 brand new authors, in addition to that, I even have the legendary Sarah Paretsky wrote our introduction for Volume 2.
She's great. Sarah is great. That'll be I'm anxious to read that one. I will be getting that book for sure. So I want to talk to you now about writing and being a writer and books and everything. How many books have you written, standalone books have you written, or books that you've written by yourself, I should say, without co-authoring or editing?
Oh, brother, you're going to make me do math now. It's sad because there are so many that I do have to sort of stop and think. I recently published my 20th book, but now if you take away the co-written ones, I guess you subtract 5 of those. And then there's the books that I have written that have yet to sell. I know I've written 26 novels. Some of them are in the process of trying to be sold. Some of them are tucked in a drawer, never to see the light of day, for very good reason.
I hear you. That's so funny. You're really, really prolific in your writing. I mean, it seems to me you're always involved in a book, whether you're writing it, co-authoring, or editing. You create a tremendous volume of work. Is it because you have a tremendous volume of ideas? What makes you so prolific?
I'm sure if you really dug down deep, it's probably a creeping fear of death and wanting to make my mark on the world. I have a lot of ideas and I have a lot of things that I want to get down on paper and a lot of things that, ultimately it comes down to, I started writing because there were stories that you would have an idea and be like, oh, I want to read that. Well, if I want to read it, then I guess I got to write it. So I keep having ideas, both as standalones or some spark, and then it's like, oh, this I could even do a couple of these. And I think there's no shortage of ideas. I'm trying to get them all out before they dry up.
So I had a show right before yours. Joe Ide was on, and I asked him the same question I'm going to ask you. Do you enjoy writing, actual sitting down and writing?
I do. When it's moving along well, I do enjoy it. I mean, I think if you are one of those writers who is sort of tortured by it, and if it's a real slog through the mud to get it done, then I don't know why you would do it. I'm certainly not making any money at it. there's no great reward in that sense. So the reward is the work for me. So yeah, I do enjoy it, because when the ideas are really flowing, and when you can put together a sentence, and I'm not one of those people who says, oh, I just sort of turn off my brain and the characters speak through me. I'm not one of those guys. I'm in control.
Sure.
It's my world. But you do get in a flow where, you know, a sentence will come out, or you make a little observation, and especially when you're reading it back, you know, weeks or months later, I'll come across something and I'll think, oh, wow, that's actually pretty good. I wrote that, huh? You know, and that's a lovely little moment when you surprise yourself.
So that's the good thing about writing. What's the worst thing about being a writer or a published author, either or maybe they're different? I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think in this day and age, you do have to take on the fact that you are, you know, a craftsman while you're sitting there and typing the pages and coming up with a story and being sort of the architect of a narrative. And while as fun as that is, when it's finished, it's got to get out there and find an audience. So I think more and more you do need to embrace the fact that there's a business side of it, and a lot more of that promotion and the business work of it is falling to the authors, especially. I mean, you know, I've published a lot of stuff. It's all been with small presses and mm-hmm. you know, books that need a lot of legwork on the author's part. I don't have a PR department, and I don't have a big distribution network working for me. So, and honestly, that's most of my contemporaries. And, you know, I think the other myth, I think when a lot of people are starting out, is you think, oh, you're on a giant New York publisher and they're just going to handle it all for you. And, you know, your books are just going to land on every Barnes & Noble and you'll sell a million. Well, no, every large press author I talk to is in the same boat. They also want maybe a little more attention from their publisher. They want a little more promotion. They want, you know, a little more from the PR department. So it's definitely a part of the business that nobody tells you ahead of time. there's a lot of work that goes into it. You have to be your own part-time publicist to go along with the creative part of the writing.
Yes, you do. And even more and more over the years, as I've worked with both very small and very large, you know, the largest publishing houses, even those that have those large houses, their clients do not get, you know, a half a year's worth of promotion. It just doesn't happen. There are just too many. And so I notice that, you know, the promotional period may last a month or a couple weeks even. It's not like authors are going on tour all over the country anymore. Only certain authors, and only for a limited amount of time, are they going anywhere. I notice that with every time I go to a book signing and I meet some, you know, I just was at Bob Crace's book signing when he was here in Florida, and he's just doing a Southern tour for this particular book that he put out. Same way with Jeff Deaver, who's still, you know, doing a Florida tour. He'll start the next someplace else when his next book comes out. And each of them have said they do a lot of their own marketing. It's like you said, it's a small business, and you got to tell everybody about it. Otherwise, who's going to go? Do you want to be with a big author, a big publishing house for some of your books? Would you prefer being with a traditional publisher versus a small press?
You know, I certainly wouldn't say no. I mean, I think everyone, you know, you want as many resources behind a book as you possibly can in order to reach the widest audience. That is definitely the goal. I mean, I certainly am not ever going to complain about the scale of the publishers that I've worked with, especially when you work with good people who do a quality product, give you a good edit, and are doing everything at the limits of their resources, even if those resources are small. And I feel like I've been very fortunate to work with a lot of different publishers, even the ones that have since gone belly up in the midst of publishing my book.
No, I know.
You were orphaned then. Yeah. But right up until the moment of implosion, they're usually pretty good people and doing their level best. But, I think, the one thing that I think the small presses have in their corner that is really appealing is a little bit more of a personal touch. I mean, obviously, if the publisher is much smaller, they're easier to get people on the phone. It's easier to talk to the top people and the real decision makers rather than just sort of go through a layer of assistance and everything like that. And I think there's a lot more direct feedback on how your book is performing. You can get actual sales numbers and all that sort of the business side of it. So, with that part of it, working with a small press is actually really good for someone like me who likes to be hands-on and who likes to know exactly what's going on and who doesn't, I've had the great pleasure of being able to design a lot of my own book covers. And as much as I would love sometimes to hand that off to somebody else and just have a much more talented artist do that, there's a certain part of me of it also that really appeals to the part of me that doesn't want to relinquish control. Or I can sort of live and die and say, look, if it's going to happen and somebody else does it and I'm not happy with it, I'm just going to be bitter. If I do it myself, I have no one to complain to except myself. So, there's certain little opportunities like that you can get afforded when you're with a small press that I actually really like.
Yeah, that's true. And that makes sense to me. How much of your painter side of you is invested in or maybe drives your desire to design book covers? And do you still paint?
I don't paint very much anymore, only because my wife was not that keen on having our house look like an art gallery. So there's only so much wall space in the world. One thing I should say is I don't paint things. I was an abstract painter, and the couple times I did art shows and stuff, I just sort of paint a lot of colors, and I do some collage and sort of multimedia stuff. But I think that there's a certain design aesthetic that I have. I think I'm good at, sort of basic composition and that kind of thing. And, just like writing the book, I certainly have a lot of ideas. When I do a book cover design, I have no idea what the standard is for doing this sort of thing, but I'll get an assignment and I'll send them back four or five different ideas and fully, fleshed out covers, and I'll say, any of these grab your fancy? And then we'll sort of zero in on one look or we'll go back to the drawing board. So that part of it is actually a lot of fun to dig in, and with, little more than a title and sort of just the back cover blurb, and be like, okay, well, let me dig in and see what can I come up with to make this an appealing looking book so that somebody else is going to want to pick it up just based on the curiosity of, hey, that's a cool looking cover, or that looks like something up my alley.
Right. I want to go back and talk about your podcast too, because you have a very different format than someone like me, my show, because I generally, unless it's a panel discussion, I generally only talk to one person at a time, and it's a longer type of a show. But you have, in your show, you have a lot of guests in one episode. So I'm assuming that the episodes are your guests are on for a shortened period of time. How does it work for someone who's never listened? What can they expect for writer types?
Yeah, well, Steve and I really set out to make basically a variety show. We wanted to have multiple guests in a couple of other segments. We have a recurring book review segment. Sometimes we've done short fiction. We've done things where if we're out and about at a conference like BoucherCon or even sometimes our local noir at the bar, we'll sort of grab some field audio and make a little piece of just, you know, field recordings. So, yeah, we end up talking with our authors. You know, we started out with three and then it's going to blow it up because we have a hard time saying no to people. But we'll talk to people for, you know, about 15 or 20 minutes, record, you know, that conversation and then cut it down to, you know, anywhere from 7 or 8 minutes. And then sometimes we go up over, you know, 10 to 12 minutes for certain guests. And we've tried to experiment a lot. We started off doing shorter and then we sort of put out a couple of questionnaires to some of the listeners to see what they're liking, and people had said, oh, you know, actually we'd like these a little bit longer. So we started to expand some of the segments. But we definitely want to keep it moving at a quick pace. We want to have something that, you know, if you're tuning in just because you know the name of maybe an A-list author, you're also going to stick around for the rest of the show and hear a couple of authors that you've never heard before and maybe, you know, find a new voice or find a new book that you want to check out just based on interviewing them. So I think it's been a lot of fun in that sense of we can do something that is real upbeat, real pacey, and something that the main thing was we wanted to do something that we felt like was a little bit different than the other stuff that's out there, because you know, with something like your show, why would we want to copy? You've already got this whole thing nailed down, so you do your thing and we'll go do our thing, you know.
Absolutely. Is there a guest you really, really want to interview?
We've been trying to get Don Winslow, and he just won't return any of our.
He's not going to return your call. Yeah, Shane's not going to let him go on anybody's show. I know. Everybody wants Don Winslow on. And yeah, that would be the get for sure. Would you like to interview Stephen King?
Oh, yeah. I would love to talk to Stephen King about the Unloaded books and about that issue, because he has some strong opinions. He's not shy about his political leanings on social media. Yeah, I mean, Stephen King's one of those guys that my sister, who's probably the most avid reader I've ever known in my life, she is a lifelong King fan, and I do believe she's read literally everything he's ever written. I mean, from the time that we were in, you know, high school or junior high, I think she was already starting with his novels. So she's been along for the ride with every single thing. So I grew up surrounded by those books. I borrowed her copy of The Shining and Skelling Crew and things like that. So as much as I don't have the patience necessarily anymore to pick up his 1,000-page or 1,200-page tomes, I certainly have a long background in history with King, and he's an institution. Why, of course, I would love to talk to him.
It's interesting you mentioned that he has some very specific views on social media, but someone of his stature can do that, whereas if you're like a little guy like me, you really can't have – you can't really voice your opinion the way you'd want to. And honestly, I don't want to so much, because it's really hard out there on social media if you have an opinion for anything other than books. So, but, you know, God bless Stephen King. Yeah, I said if he ever came on my show, that would be the last show I ever did. That would be the one that I'd say, okay, I've done it all now. You know, I mean, I've had some really great guests, as have you. I think we share a lot of the same guests, but yeah, that would be the one that I'd say, don't have to do this anymore. And, you know, there you go. And I also want, I dearly wanted to interview Sue Grafton, and unfortunately, you know, she passed away after a very serious illness, and that was sad. But listen, I'll take Stephen King. It's okay. What is something about you? What is something we don't know about you that you'd be willing to share?
That's a good question. I feel sometimes in this era of social media, don't you feel like it's all out there at some point? Sometimes when you kind of wish you could take some stuff back.
You wish you didn't say you weren't in the sharing mood all the time. I can understand that. Good or bad, I'm not asking for, you know, I'm not asking for personal information, but what would we be surprised to learn about you?
I'm trying to think of something that's surprising. I mean, you know, you mentioned that I met Barry Manilow, so there's, you know, that's out of the way.
I'm looking at that right now. So we must be having like mental telepathy or something. I'm looking that on your website and thinking, how in the hell did you meet Barry Manilow? And more importantly, why? Okay, so fill us in. Let's have the scoop on this.
It's not nearly as exciting as it sounds. It just makes for a good bio page. But my lovely wife Marie, she and I could not be more different. We are a perfect example of opposites attract, and it is never more evident than in our musical tastes. So there was one year around Christmas time, and her birthday is in December. So she's spent a lifetime of just getting screwed with birthday presents, sort of conflating with Christmas presents, and
Right. She
always got the short end of the stick. So one year I had it designed where every month in December I brought her to a different concert. So, it was bands that we, you know, liked in common, or at least that I liked enough that I was willing to bring her and take her out for a night. And it culminated in I got her tickets to see Barry Manilow at the Universal Amphitheater here in L.A., and it was on, you know, December 20th. It was like leading up to his big New Year's Eve show. And, you know, she – anything that's in like that, you know, mid-70s AM light rock, that is my wife's wheelhouse.
Really?
I thought
– Really?
Yeah, don't get
oh
me
my God.
But
sorry, Marie.
After giving her all of these other concerts, and she was really loving it, and each one was a surprise. But I was leading up to, I thought she was going to be so excited. I thought she was just really going to freak out. So I finally was like, and here's the big finale. And I gave her the tickets, and she sort of looked at me like, what, are you serious? We're going to see Barry Manilow? And she was a little bit underwhelmed. And I sort of was like, oh, I thought you'd be so excited. She came around and she got really excited. I think at first she thought it was a joke, though. She's like, you would never be caught dead at a Barry Manilow show. Cut to.
That is so funny.
It's the night of the show, and there was the local radio station was having, like, you know, it's a pre-show, you know, get together at a local restaurant. So we're like, oh, we'll go there, and they, you know, free hors d'oeuvres or whatever. So we go to this little pre-show thing, and they're giving away, you know, concert t-shirts and that stuff. And the big prize was backstage passes to meet Barry before the show. Lo and behold, we won. The cherry on top of this wonderful gift. So what I did in my idiot ways, we get backstage, they trot out, here comes Barry, and he looks great, and he's about to give a great show, and he's got a lot of things to do. He's been doing this for 40 years. He was very polite. He shook our hands, and I, you know, what do you say to Barry Manilow? Well, all I could think to say was to recount the story of how underwhelmed my wife was about these tickets.
You didn't. You did.
And she's elbowing me. I did. She's elbowing me. And I'm sort of like, no, no, but we're very excited to be here. And she's like, oh, my God, what are you doing? Don't tell him.
Oh, my God. Did you not realize what you were saying? You've since become You've since become a more polished speaker, I assume, right?
I must have just been so starstruck.
Okay. That's it. My whole concept of you has now changed irrevocably. I'm telling you, this is an irrevocable thing. I can never get this conversation out of my head. that'll do it. That's the one thing about you that one takes the cake for sure.
Okay.
So that's too funny. You've done a lot of fun things, though, in your life. You really have. Is there something on your bucket list that you just say, I got to do this. I got to do this before my life is over?
There's definitely a lot more travel that I would like to do. I've never been to
Sure.
any of the Scandinavian countries. I would really love to do that. You know, your travel tends to shrink a little bit when you bring kids into the house. So
that works.
Yeah,
kids and pets, you can't leave them alone. I don't understand that, you know. If not for needing babysitters for them, you could do whatever you wanted.
Hey, 9 years old, I was spending way too much time by myself. These kids are just hampered nowadays.
And see what happens? You learn to speak so eloquently to superstars.
That's right.
Oh, you're never going to live this one down. I am telling everyone this story.
Hey, I am proud. I was able to tell him exactly. You know, I told him the truth. It wasn't. And again, like I couched the whole thing with like, but we're happy to be here now. And I'll tell you this, the man puts on a hell of a show.
Eric, there's no backtracking on this one. You can't walk it back no matter how hard you try.
I stand by it. I stand by it.
There you go. So I want to pose a question to you or something for your consideration. Later after this show, I'm going to call Marie and say, let's write a book about Eric. What do you think we're going to title it?
Oh, brother.
And that might just be it.
Yeah, no. Don't. I don't know. It's probably going to be, you know, like an early grave, because I'm sure that the amount of stuff that I do is going to drive me to a death far younger than I probably deserve.
No, it's going to make you live far longer than you ever wanted to. But you'll be of sound mind, maybe not of sound body, because you kept exercising your brain so much. I did not talk about your books, and I do want to just get a couple of minutes in on the new ones. You have this great trilogy that you've just now got up on Amazon. I really like it a lot. It sounds delightful. Besides, let's talk about Lars and Shane, please.
Yeah. Well, the Lars and Shane books, starting with The Devil Doesn't Want Me, is the first one. And then I just finally, after all these years, released the finale of the trilogy, The Devil at Your Door. These books, I think, for the people that sometimes ask me, you know, with so many books, people say, where should I start? What should I read first? The Devil Doesn't Want Me is usually the book that I point people to more than any other, because I think it's one of the best examples of what I do well, and I think that's writing about criminals or people that are on a questionable side of the law and yet making them relatable or at least rootable. So I think someone like Lars, he's a professional killer. He's a hitman. But I think I've had such a great response from readers since the book first came out in 2012, that he's someone that they really root for, and that someone that they want to see, you know, make it out alive, because it's always kind of a question mark hanging over him. So I think that these books are filled with a lot of mayhem and a lot of twists and turns and crazy violence, but there's a beating heart at the center of them, and that's the kind of thing that I always try to infuse into my crime novels.
What I find interesting about these is the characters of Lars and Shane themselves. They are the noir odd couple. Does that sound right?
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things where it's like you have, you know, Lars is an older guy.
Right.
And then he meets Shane, who's you know, a teenager when they first meet, and he sort of has to take her under his wing and save her from the life that he's been drawn into, because she's an innocent in his world, and he knows sort of the difference between right and wrong, even though he oftentimes plays the wrong side of the fence. But having them join forces, being these sort of, you know, the light and the dark of it all, I think makes for interesting characters and puts them in a lot of interesting situations where you have to have someone like Lars, who's sort of going through this change of, you know, he's really spends his time trying to leave behind this life that he's built for himself and to see if there actually is a reinvention that he can even pull off after the horrible things that he's done. And she kind of helps him find his humanity again along the way. But at the same time, he also is taking the hard lessons that he knows about the real world and trying to give her the defenses to survive in a world that he knows, or at least he thinks, is rather cruel. So it gets them into a lot of trouble, but hopefully it also helps each of them grow in their own way.
It is truly a yin and a yang relationship that they have. You were, when you said light and dark, that's the thought that came into my mind. And eventually, she has to go someplace where he really doesn't want her to go, right? In book three,
yeah,
Devil at
I
Your
mean,
Door. Yeah.
Yeah. She's been through a lot of trauma. I mean, you know, she ends up with Lars through no choice of her own, and she, you know, ends up basically losing everything and having to sort of rebuild a life with this really, you know, not the father figure that you would really choose in life. And you're going to be haunted by something like that, and you're going to want to sort of put the ghost of your past behind you. And in a way, he spends a lot of his time trying to protect her from going down the road that he's gone on, and tries to show her that, you know, revenge for revenge sake is maybe not the best idea. But at the same time, he knows that he can use his set of skills to maybe exercise some of those demons for her, and that kind of drives a lot of the mayhem that happens in book three and The Devil at Your Door.
Well, congratulations on them. I really like these books a lot. And did you design the covers?
I did. You know, it's funny, when we were speaking of like indie publishers and going belly up, books have been through three different publishers. So The Devil Doesn't Want Me, this is the third different release of this book, and therefore the third cover, and this is the first time that I've actually had my crack at designing the covers for these. So I did all three covers, people seem to like them. So yeah, but this is one of the few books that I've had other people do the covers for the first couple of editions, and with varying degrees of the very first release of The Devil Doesn't Want Me, I was never that thrilled with. I liked the second edition of them well enough, but then there was some confusion. They were too similar. So now I've designed these, and hopefully they do the job.
I am looking at your website for covers, and that's called crimecovers.blogspot.com. You have a very distinct aesthetic, but you also – every single book is so different and so interesting looking, and I like them very, very much. Congratulations. Let's tell everyone where they can find you, because damn, if you're not all over the place, I don't know who is. You're everywhere. So start where we want to find you first. Where is the best place to find out all the different places you are?
Well, there's this. Simply ericbeatner.com is my official author website, and I do my best to keep it updated with any new release news and appearances and all that good stuff. I don't update it maybe as much as I should, but it's pretty up to date with every place that I'm going to be and things that are coming out. And then you can always find me on Facebook, or I'm on Twitter. And, you know, do the old Google search, and my name comes up way too much. My kids will search my name, and they're always amazed, and then they say, "Dad, there's bad words there." And then I embarrass them.
Boy, don't ever let them read your books. You know, not yet anyway. They're way too young.
No.
Eric Beatner, you are just a delight to talk to, and I know I didn't throw you nearly enough hard balls tonight. Probably not any, because you've been, you know, you're the consummate pro here. But I want to thank you for being on the show. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope you'll come back sometime. And maybe even you'll take a shot in the host seat for me and pick someone to interview. It would be fun listening to it.
Yeah, anytime. I'm sure you probably have a lot of days where you're like, screw this, I need a break.
Listen, I'm supposed to do one show a week, okay? This week I'm doing seven. So I've long given up the thought that I'm going to sit and do one show a week. It's just not going to work. I like writers too much, and I feel honored to be part of the tribe. So I am definitely going to be talking to as many people as I can. But I sure would love to come and have a seasoned pro like you do an interview. So let's talk about that, okay?
All right, let's see if we can trick Don Winslow into doing it.
Yeah, right. I've been trying for years. David Corbett and I tried. Everybody's tried. It's just not going to happen. Stick with me just for a second. Tomorrow night on my regular show, I start off the day with John Lesqua, who's just a terrific guy. And then I'm going to talk to one of the best women's fiction writers I know. Her name is Carolyn Brown. We'll be talking to her. She's out in Oklahoma. And then Nick Kolakowski, who is a fellow Down and Out Books writer with Eric, is coming on. And we're going to talk about his series, too. I hope that you join me. Eric, you're the best. Thank you for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
All right. We'll talk again soon. Thank you. Good night.
Great. Good night.
And that's our show for tonight, folks. Thanks for being with me. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.